This is the takeaway for Wednesday, July 19th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for being with us today. This week, after more than 7 years of vowing to repeal and replace Obamacare, Republican leaders once again came up short. Several weeks ago, it was Plan A, repeal and replace. Then this week, Plan B, repeal and replace with more money. That failed. And yesterday, Plan C, repeal Obamacare with no replacement and push lawmakers to the table to find a new agreement over the next 2 years. That idea survived for only a couple of hours before too many GOP senators said they're not voting for it. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says he'll keep trying with more votes next week, but as of now, he cannot get 50 Republicans to agree on what to do about health care. Meanwhile, the president is convinced that the Affordable Care Act will fall apart under its own weight.
Let Obamacare fail, and then everybody's going to have to come together and fix it and come up with a new plan and a plan that's really good for the people with much lower premiums, much lower costs, and much better protection. I've been saying that, Mike, I think you'll agree, for a long time. Let Obamacare fail. It'll be a lot easier.
A big question now, would the ACA fail if it were left alone? If repeal doesn't have the votes, where is the ACA working? Where does it need fixing? And is there any place where Republicans who've staked their political lives on repeal could join with Democrats to repair it? Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is one of the people who knows the Affordable Care Act best because he helped write it with the Obama administration. He's also advised President Trump and Republicans on alternatives, and he's author of the new book, Prescription for the Future. It's all about the future of healthcare in America. Dr. Emanuel, welcome.
Great to be here.
You watched over the last month in the Senate along with the rest of us. Now, we know that conservatives wanted more repeal. We know moderates wanted to protect Medicaid. And as I just mentioned, the whole effort fell apart three times. But from way back here, from a perch way back from the Senate and from Washington, and the last 7 years of Republicans attacking Obamacare, what's been happening? What's going on? And why can't Republicans pass repeal?
The Affordable Care Act is doing well. There's still been some problems with it, as everyone knows, problems with the exchanges that need some attention, that doesn't need radical surgery. It needs a sort of three or four very focused reforms that would actually help the exchanges, reforms such as we need to guarantee these so-called cost-sharing subsidies, payments to families making less than $70,000 that help them pay the deductible and the co-payments on their insurance. We need risk corridors that were in the original Affordable Care Act, that is, payments to insurance companies if they get too many sick people. Marco Rubio pulled those out after the exchanges had started, and it upset the insurance companies. Those two changes alone would bring premiums down in most of the exchanges. We could use some better targeted advertising, strict enforcement of the mandate. And finally, a new idea created by the Center for American Progress would be, well, if an insurance company goes into one of those counties that doesn't have a lot of insurance companies or no insurance companies in the exchange, maybe they get tax relief from the Affordable Care Act's taxes on insurance companies to provide a kind of financial incentive for them to go into rural counties and other places that don't have many insurance offerings. Those kind of reforms, all very doable. I think Lamar Alexander is going to get to them. Those would actually enhance the exchanges, and again, make the Affordable Care Act work even better.
So the president now says that the best bet is just to let Obamacare fail, watch it falter, and then politicians everywhere will clamor to the table to solve the crisis. That's his plan. There's one or two Republicans in Congress who agree with that. What does do nothing look like from the reality of the ACA, let's say over the next 2 years? The term death spiral gets thrown around, but the reality of the ACA looks like what 2 years from now if nothing's done?
Well, partly there's no such thing as doing nothing. You know, in healthcare, you're constantly doing things, and the Department of Health and Human Services is constantly having to make rules regarding the health insurance marketplace, actually putting out and operating the exchanges. One of the consequences of President Trump's statement that he wants to see the exchanges fail is if they do fail, it's his fault. He's in control of HHS. His secretary, Price, is in control. They actually operate most of the exchanges in the country. They own it if it fails. And the American public is not going to blame President Obama. They're going to blame this administration and the Republicans. They are making choices day to day that affect the exchanges. If there is a death spiral, and let's remind your listeners, a death spiral means that only sick people buy insurance, driving up the premiums. Healthy people decide not to buy insurance. Premiums go up even more, and eventually you basically have no insurance. People are simply paying their health care bills. If that happens, that's a direct result of decisions made by the Secretary of Health and Human Services and this administration.
Let's talk about people's premiums and more broadly their out-of-pocket costs, because people pay more than just premiums. They pay deductibles. They pay other forms of cost sharing. One problem with the Affordable Care Act is premiums are rising in a lot of places more quickly than people thought they would. That'll happen, you know, when a bunch of sick people who used to be locked out of insurance suddenly have it, but that's where we are. The Obama administration really fell short in getting enough younger, healthier people to sign up for the price of what was on offer. And if they stay away, it's more expensive for everyone else and premiums go up. How important is that, and what can be done now realistically to get more of those younger, cheaper, healthier people into the pool?
I don't mean to be disrespectful, but there are a lot of assumptions you put in there that are factually not true.
Okay.
Today, premiums in the exchanges are exactly the place that the Congressional Budget Office said they would be. They started out lower than projected, and they came higher. And one of the reasons, a main reason they came up, is the fact that Marco Rubio in the Senate pulled and reversed a policy we had in the Affordable Care Act to give the insurance companies risk orders and reinsurance so that if they got too many sick people, they would be compensated for that. Marco Rubio took that compensation away. And when you take that compensation away, the insurance companies need to protect themselves from that risk of having too many sick people, and they raise their premiums. Put that back, and you can see premiums come down 7 to 10%. Guarantee the cost-sharing subsidies. As I mentioned before, these are payments to families to help them with the deductibles in the exchanges. You'll see premiums come down again because insurance companies won't be liable for those premiums. Tell the insurance companies we're going to vigorously enforce the mandate so they can be assured that more young and healthy people are going to come in. Again, that brings premiums down. I think we should take out a lot more targeted advertising. You know, Google knows what people's income is. Google knows whether they have health insurance or not. You could target people with ads saying, you know, you can get health insurance on your state exchange for the following amount of money with a subsidy. That will help too.
You mentioned the cost sharing reductions that are embedded in the ACA. This is tens of billions of dollars that go to insurance companies to offset some of the costs under Obamacare. What does it mean to the industry when the president threatens to withhold those payments, when members of Congress threaten to withhold them, or when members of Congress say they're not going to let that money go unless there's broader reform? That's what John Cornyn said yesterday.
Yeah. So first of all, we probably made a mistake in the drafting of the Affordable Care Act and not putting those in and guaranteeing their funding. And there is a question about their funding. It's the subject of a lawsuit. The House of Representatives sued the Obama administration and now the Trump administration about those subsidies. Both the Trump administration and Congress asked the judge to not make the case go forward. The cost-sharing subsidies are continuing, although there's uncertainty about them because of statements like that by Senator Cornyn. One of the consequences of that kind of uncertainty, those kind of statements that we're not funding it, is that insurance companies, again, to reduce their risk of losing money, jack up premiums to cover the costs of those subsidies, which they're liable for. You want to reduce premiums? One of the easiest things to do is say, oh, those cost-sharing subsidies, we're just going to build it into the budget, and we're not going to argue about it year to year. We're not going to make them uncertain. We're going to actually smooth out this business. I think that actually is going to happen. The only way we wouldn't get agreement is if the Republican leadership doesn't permit a vote on it. Because if you permitted a vote on it today, it would pass overwhelmingly with both Democrats and Republicans coming to agreement.
Dr. Zeke Emanuel, you know, one of the most remarkable things for me over the last several months of this debate has been Medicaid. You know, if you had told me 5 years ago that in a Republican world and a Republican Congress, repeal efforts would fail because too many Republican senators say, don't touch Medicaid, don't let the Medicaid expansion go away, my state needs it, and I'm not going to let you touch it. I would have thought you were crazy. But Medicaid, this massive program for low-income people, largely low-income working people, has not only survived this fight, but has survived in a way that says, don't go after it for years to come. It's pretty remarkable.
I couldn't agree with you more. I was in the same place you were, which is, well, you know, Medicaid's at best a second best solution. It's never anyone's first choice. Andy Slavitt, who headed CMS, the part of the government that oversees Medicaid, told me when he came in to the job, he was most skeptical about Medicaid. And when he left the job, he was most impressed with Medicaid and how it was helping working Americans. It's hard for state senators and governors to say, you know, let's cut those people off and deny them insurance. Hospitals depend upon it. Doctors depend upon it. Pharmacies depend upon it. And those people, to continue working and to continue to be healthy, depend upon it. That seems to be a system that's working. And again, I'm as surprised as you that it would Medicaid would suddenly be the cornerstone of the healthcare reform and something some Republican senators would come to defend.
Let's leave this on politics before I let you go, Dr. Emanuel. Is the fever broken now, do you think, having watched the last month and a half in the Senate? Is the idea of full repeal dead and Republicans will come to some conclusion that they have to fix Obamacare? Or do you think that this continues?
No, this doesn't continue. I don't think anyone can take much more of this. This is, people get exhausted in Washington by things. And we've had now it's almost exactly, I think tomorrow is exactly 6 months of the administration. And I think people are like, no more. I do think some things are going to have to be done to shore up the exchanges. The question is whether we could come to a broader approach that really does address the affordability problem, which is the primary concern of most Americans, affordability. And I think, again, as I've said, and I've been saying this for months and months and months, there are bipartisan policies that you can adopt. And I do think that going forward, that's where the focus should be. Without the drama, without a lot of rigmarole, let's be just much more businesslike. We don't need to talk behind closed doors. We can actually have hearings. We can do it via the usual legislative process. I've often joked that, you know, you take three or four politicians and policy experts from the left and three or four from the right. You lock them up in Camp David until they come up with a policy. They'll come up with a policy pretty quickly that they can agree on.
Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is one of the architects of Obamacare. He's advised Republicans, too, and he's author of Prescription for the Future. Dr. Emanuel, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
California is on fire again. This month, fires in the state have burned more than 200,000 acres from Santa Barbara to Butte County in Northern California. So far, the fires have forced thousands of people to evacuate and destroyed dozens of homes. Just yesterday, California Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency in Mariposa County outside of Yosemite National Park, where County Sheriff Doug Binweis told KFSN-TV that responders are dealing with a new kind of wildfire.
I can't emphasize enough how active and erratic this fire activity is, especially with this fire. It's done stuff that we haven't seen before.
Something they haven't seen before in Mariposa County, but according to Gary Ferguson, it's the new normal of more intense, hotter, and more frequent wildfires. Ferguson is author of Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West, and he says the nature of wildfire has changed dramatically because of humans.
Since the new millennium, 2000, we have had 10 fire seasons with over a dozen so-called megafires, which are defined as single incidents of over 100,000 acres. That's a phenomenal increase. So the fires are, in general, burning bigger and hotter, and they have more lasting side effects, both to the communities that are near these fires as well as to the landscapes themselves. Part of this is due to an increase in fuel loads through the 20th century, and that is coming smack up against climate change. So it's a bit of a perfect storm leading to these so-called mega fires.
You also talk about how the nature of the Western forest itself has changed since the 1800s.
You know, because of harvesting activity, and certainly because we fought fires so aggressively through the 20th century, we've got an accumulation of what's called fuel load in the forest. It's important for your listeners to understand that in the West, the arid West, plants and trees decompose not by the micro processes that are present in wetter climates, but really through fire. And so through that aggressive suppression especially, we're now sitting on 300 million acres, and that's roughly three times the size of California, with unnaturally heavy fuel loads. And those fuel loads are really the most significant change in the forest since certainly the mid-1800s.
Now, wait a second. When I was a kid, and I guess even into today, there were massive public relations campaigns, of course, with Smokey the Bear. Only you can prevent forest fires. Preventing them and fighting them was a big deal. Are you suggesting that this wasn't the best idea for the health of the Western forest?
Well, it's a good idea in a lot of circumstances, but in America, we love to declare war on things, and we literally did declare war on wildfire. Unfortunately, the West, the forest that you walk through today and you see, was shaped over thousands of years by these lesser so-called stand maintenance fires, which nature would trigger off about every 8 or 10 or 12 years. And those smaller, lower temperature fires would burn through the forest and check diseases and insects, and also clean that forest debris off the ground. So by being a little over enthusiastic, we've created this really difficult situation now that we're struggling mightily to try to remedy with things like thinning and prescribed burning. So it wasn't that it was bad to put out fires, but we got a little over eager.
Well, how have they changed the fires themselves?
Because of the increased fuel load and because of drier, warmer conditions, severe droughts, again, much of this related to human-caused climate change, the fires are burning instead of, say, 1,200 or 1,300 degrees, which these stand maintenance fires of hundreds of years ago would have burned at. Now they're burning at 2,000, 2,200 degrees. They're becoming so large that they're creating their own weather systems and often wind systems. This makes them not only advance very quickly, but it puts wildfire fighters' lives in jeopardy. It's interesting to note that wildland firefighters only make up about 5% of career firefighters, but their death rate is about six times higher. There's been a pretty significant increase in firefighter deaths because of just the size and the unpredictable nature of wildfire when it gets to a certain size, what this is causing as far as the danger level, and lots of potential destruction and actual destruction to nearby communities that live on the edge of these national forests.
And let's talk about those communities, because they're a critical piece in the puzzle here. You mentioned fires that burn hotter and longer, fire seasons that are longer and drier, not to mention a dirtier forest floor, frankly, with lots of fuel in it. People are also living right up against the places where these fires take place. That means property damage. That means a risk to humans as they flee, and also a risk to firefighters who have to get in there and try to protect towns.
There's something called the wildland-urban interface, which really is easily defined by any structure, mostly homes, that come up against large swaths of natural vegetation. And out of about 2.3 billion acres in the United States, believe it or not, a billion of those, about 40% of the American landscape, is in this wildland-urban interface. Tremendous growth. The wildland-urban interface is growing as far as developments at a rate of about 4,000 acres a day, well over a million acres a year. And thus far, it's only been developed to a degree of about 24%. So we have 86% of that wildland-urban interface still to be developed.
So if humans continue to build near the interface zone, which I think we're pretty sure they're going to, Gary, what does the future of living with fire look like in America with all of these factors that you've described?
Well, existing communities can certainly, with a little help from the Forest Service or local fire departments, start actively managing their homes and their developments with thinning operations around the developments. They can put non-flammable materials on in a 5-foot apron around their houses. They can put screened vents over their attic. Very simple things that have tremendous effect. Now, ultimately, these big fires are just going to keep burning, and they're going to keep knocking on the doors of these subdivisions, and they're going to threaten ranch lands, and they're going to change the face of the forest that we've loved for a very long time. And I would imagine at some point, hopefully sooner than later, we'll be willing to simply get real and start discussing what we can do, not just to make the forest less flammable or less subject to these big fires, but also to take responsibility for climate change so that the folks who are living in the West 50 years or 100 years from now actually have a habitable landscape to call home.
The book is Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West. Author Gary Ferguson, thank you.
Thanks, Todd. It's been a pleasure.
My number one priority is to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran.
That was Donald Trump as a presidential candidate speaking in front of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, back in March. Almost 6 months into his presidency now, Trump did something you might not expect, given that statement. On Monday, he informed Congress that Iran is complying with the terms of the nuclear deal. The declaration seemed grudging. The White House followed it by saying Iran is not abiding by the spirit of that nuclear deal. And it also announced new sanctions targeting 18 Iranian individuals and groups for their support of Iran's ballistic missile program. Robin Wright is back with us. She's a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute for Peace. Robin, welcome.
Great to be with you.
What do you make of the White House's move here to announce that Iran is complying with the framework of the nuclear deal, but not its spirit?
Well, this decision did not come easily. The president has tried to defy the advice of his top foreign policy and military team, who urged him to certify that Iran has complied with the nuclear deal. But the president clearly wants to either amend it, renegotiate it, or end the most important nonproliferation agreement in a quarter century. And the administration has taken the first steps. At the same time, it certified that Iran is complying by imposing new sanctions on 18 entities or people in Iran, and clearly intends to do more.
What do you think is making President Trump now so adamant in his intention to undo the Iran deal, now stating that it should continue, at least in the short term?
Well, for the president, the nuclear deal is to foreign policy what healthcare is to domestic policy, his top priority. But he has to figure out a way to do it. And the policy review on Iran is not yet complete. So this is a stopgap measure that the administration has taken. It will have to be recertified in 90 days. And the president has indicated to his staff that he doesn't want to do that because of the issue that Iran is violating the spirit of the accord, even if not the technical aspects of the accord.
You met yesterday with Iran's foreign minister, Robin Wright. What did he have to say?
Well, the foreign minister had a number of things to say. First of all, that it's not clear to Iran exactly what the Trump administration wants to do, but he rejected the prospect of any kind of a renegotiation. He said it was hard enough over 2 years to come to terms, and that all sides felt they didn't get all of their demands met, and that any attempt to renegotiate would only raise expectations and make the demands even tougher by all sides. He said that was just a non-starter. He said he had not yet talked to anyone in the administration, in stark contrast to his regular communications with Secretary of State Kerry, who he said probably had involved more contact between two foreign ministers than any other foreign ministers in history. And that may well be true. They talk so often. But he said he is open to talking to Secretary of State Tillerson on implementation. And the two sides do meet on technical issues and will later this week in Vienna. But those are strictly about how to implement the deal. But he said, in light of the new sanctions, Iran will reciprocate. And Iran's parliament has already taken measures in providing new funding for Iran's missile program, very controversial. as well as for the Revolutionary Guards and its elite Quds Force.
New sanctions from the Trump administration as the Iran nuclear deal is extended, but guarantees of retaliation from Iran. Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute for Peace. Robin, thanks again.
Thank you.
Our hearts are broken, and we are utterly devastated by the loss of Justine. We've lost the dearest of people, and we're desperate for information.
Another questionable police shooting over the weekend in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This time the victim was Justine Damond, a 40-year-old white woman from Australia. She was living in Minneapolis with her fiancé, Don, who you just heard from there, and his son. Details are still unclear, but Damond called 911 to report an alleged assault in an alley outside of her home. After that, she was shot and killed by a police officer named Mohammed Noor. There was no recording of the incident, and that's only increased the scrutiny of exactly what happened. It's also left a Minneapolis community again dealing with a troubling police shooting just over a year after the death of Philando Castile. Nikema Levy-Pounds is a civil rights attorney, police reform activist, and a candidate for mayor in Minneapolis. She's here with a view from the community. Nikema, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
What's been the response in Minneapolis to this shooting?
Outrage, shock, and concern regarding the conduct of the Minneapolis Police Department and the fact that we know that urgent reform is desperately needed.
Now, the officers on the scene were wearing body cameras, but they weren't turned on, so there's no video. Is this routine in the Minneapolis police force?
Well, just a week before this particular incident, a local news station ran a story discussing the fact that the majority of officers were not logging body cam hours. So maybe 5 to 6 hours on average were being logged by police officers. You would think within that 1 week span of time that the department would have acted with more urgency and mandated officers to record their interactions with civilians through their body cameras, but that was not the case, you know, nor was their dash cam video available or even audio for that matter, calling into question the chain of events that occurred and why Justine is not alive today. Now, I'm not sure if you all are aware, but in November of 2015, a young man by the name of Jamar Clark was shot in the head and killed by two Minneapolis police officers. And initially, his case was started to be investigated by the Minneapolis Police Department. We actually called out for a third-party independent investigation, and the mayor's office and the department sent that case over to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Now, why that is important is because in the past, Minneapolis Police Department had investigated itself anytime an officer-involved shooting happened. And so we said, you know, we don't trust Minneapolis Police Department to investigate itself. Now, the challenge is that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has a terrible track record for holding officers accountable when they shoot civilians. So when we think about a third party independent investigation, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension really does not fit that criteria because these are police officers investigating other police officers in an environment that has routinely failed to hold officers accountable when they kill civilians.
What do you want to see from the department and the city?
You know, the mayor in a press conference last night talked about, you know, this being a senseless tragedy. And so when you look at Jamar Clark being killed, some of those sentiments weren't expressed in the same way. And so it's giving people a sense that this case is being treated much differently when you have a young African-American male victim who was demonized in the public eye versus a white female victim who is largely being celebrated in the public eye. And that's causing concern for people. The hope, though, is that this tragedy will actually lead to not only a wake-up call across the state of Minnesota and in this nation regarding the fact that we have militarized police forces that are out of control and unfortunately are not held accountable for their actions, and that those reforms would be sweeping in the state of Minnesota and across the nation.
Nikema Levy-Pounds, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nakima Levy-Pounds is a civil rights attorney, a police reform activist, and a candidate for mayor in Minneapolis. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Before the 2016 election, the fringes of American politics weren't considered that important in presidential campaigns. That changed when then-candidate Donald Trump found support in the outskirts of the Republican Party, and soon the alt-right and its news outlets made up an important part of Trump's political base, and then they pushed from the fringes closer to the center. Now the Trump presidency is in a crisis brought by Russian interference in the 2016 campaign. Several investigations are looking at what the Russians did and whether members of the Trump campaign cooperated or coordinated with them. The president, meanwhile, calls the Russia investigation a witch hunt and anyone who reports on it fake news. Sites like Breitbart and personalities like Alex Jones of InfoWars also report on Russia. Here's Alex Jones responding to the June meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer after being told it was part of Russia's effort to help the Trump campaign.
The only crime of Donald Jr. is not being more hardcore. The only crime is not speaking up and halfway apologizing on Sean Hannity last night, saying he could have done it a little bit different looking back. No, day one, they should have said, you bet we're talking to the Russians about how you sold out our uranium and how you're a traitor. And when we get the evidence, we're going to put your in prison, Hillary.
Alex Jones there is talking about a conspiracy theory, how the real story isn't Russia meddling in 2016, but how U.S. uranium was sold to the Russians in exchange for donations to the Clinton Foundation. Conspiracies like this often originate in places like InfoWars or online message boards like 4chan, and they're nothing new, but they carry a completely separate story of the presidency than you'll see in mainstream news, and now their readers include the president himself. George Hawley is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Alabama. He's also author of Making Sense of the Alt-Right. He says the audience for fringe news sites has soared.
These are quite large. When you think about Breitbart, it claims that it had 2 billion page views in 2016. I was just looking at some information about InfoWars, and according to Quantcast, it had about 500 million page views last year. And of course, sources like Drudge Report can have over a billion views in a month.
If you're a reader, a frequent reader of some of these sites, what's your experience of the Russia story, the story of Russian infiltration of the 2016 election, and then all of the investigations and the fallout after that?
Well, when we think about sort of the pro-Trump media, that is, those media sources that are rather unreservedly supportive and enthusiastic about Trump, which of course is not a group that's entirely synonymous with the alt-right, just to be clear. The general attitude is that there really is no Russia story of any significance, that it is a concoction by the media, or that Trump officials have been set up by either the Democrats or by the so-called deep state, and it's all an effort to undermine Trump and his administration.
Well, let's take the most recent case then, since you alluded to it, the visit that Donald Trump Jr. and Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner had with a Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, several other people, and an email chain that Donald Trump Jr. published himself suggesting that he was told that this meeting was part of the Russian government's attempt to help his father's campaign. If I'm reading Breitbart or Drudge or 4chan or InfoWars, what is that story to me?
Well, there's a couple of different ways that this has been approached. One has been that, well, this was a totally normal meeting. And of course, if you think that somebody has potentially useful opposition research for you, you are going to take that meeting, regardless of what the source of the information was. The other viewpoint is that, well, this was actually all a setup. That is, that Loretta Lynch allowed this Russian lawyer into the country specifically so that this meeting would take place and it would provide some ammunition against the Trump campaign. So a rather convoluted conspiracy theory, but one that has been repeated multiple times.
Here's the president acknowledging that narrative in a press conference with the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, last week.
The lawyer that went to the meeting, I see that she was in the halls of Congress also. Somebody said that her visa or her passport to come into the country was approved by Attorney General Lynch. Now, maybe that's wrong. I just heard that a little while ago.
What does it mean when the president himself utters the conspiracy theory from his position.
Well, it certainly strengthens theories like that, and the fact that there is a massive audience for websites and other venues pushing these sorts of stories means that the story is going to make it into general circulation.
Well, I want to take the big story that started all of the stories that we're talking about, which is the hack of the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta himself, released on WikiLeaks. That story gets played how?
There is a different story that is being promoted, and that is that the hack was quite likely the result of the efforts of a young man named Seth Rich, who was a Democratic National Committee employee who was murdered in Washington, D.C. a year ago. And based on the timing of the hack and of the murder, it was speculated within certain right-wing media circles that Rich was actually the source of the DNC emails and he was murdered as a result. This story was initially pushed on certain right-wing message boards, but eventually began to migrate its way towards bigger venues, such as InfoWars, for example, and then finally actually ended up getting picked up by Fox News' Sean Hannity.
And I am not backing off asking questions, even though there is an effort that nobody talk about Seth Rich. This kid got shot in the back. They said it was a robbery, yet he had his watch, his wallet, and his phone. I don't believe it's a robbery.
So it definitely grew to encompass media venues that have a very large audience.
So what can we draw about these websites and their readers, George Hawley, when it's the unanimous assessment of the U.S. intelligence community that an attack like this happened and they know who's behind it? What does it tell us about the spirit, the intent, or the feeling behind what I'm calling the alt-right when these conclusions are rejected as conspiracy?
Well, I think it demonstrates a total lack of credibility of these institutions in the eyes of a significant portion of the American population. And to some, especially some of the more conspiracy-minded folks, the very fact that the CIA is pushing something is itself evidence that it's not true. And I don't think a few years ago, huge percentages of people, especially Republicans, would have said that CNN is fake news. I think that even if there was a recognition that it had a liberal bias, this notion that it was simply lying and making things up was not really a meme within Republican circles, but now it has become one. So to some extent, the president seems to be feeding into this by embracing this notion that a lot of mainstream news sources are simply not to be trusted. And then when you combine that with the fact that the president himself has said favorable things and even appeared on the show of Alex Jones, it seems to be contributing to this as well.
George Hawley is assistant professor of political science at the University of Alabama. His new book, out in September, is Making Sense of the Alt-Right. Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Thank you.
By the way, you can see a complete interactive timeline of the Russia investigation. It's on our website over at thetakeaway.org.
Now to new reactions on what's been dubbed Pizzagate.
A conspiracy theory called Pizzagate.
Northwest DC neighborhood pizza joint is fighting back tonight after it suspects a massive coordinated online attack.
The fake news inspired visit by gunmen to a Washington DC pizzeria to investigate claims of a child sex trafficking ring being run out of the location by Hillary Clinton.
And the craziest fake news of all is something called Pizzagate.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. And when you hear that term fake news, you might think Pizzagate, the very untrue story of what happened behind closed doors at a DC pizza restaurant during the 2016 campaign. That fake story with very real consequences has come to symbolize in a lot of ways the danger of unverified or invented news. If you use social media, you have probably come across a fake story at some point. It might be a Facebook post. It might be a link to a story on a website that looks reputable, but really isn't. Everyone is vulnerable to false stories on the left and the right, but kids can be immersed in their online lives, and schools and libraries are now looking for ways to arm young people against fake news. The Miami-Dade Public Library System is one of them. It's offering a digital program called Checkology to help make kids and teens more educated news consumers.
Basically, the software is based on civics, good government, ethics in government, ethics and journalism. So I know teachers are doing things like that in schools. And librarians could develop a program after this model. They would just have to base it on open discussions and being unbiased.
That's Jennifer Shipley. She's Library Operations Administrator for Community Engagement and Programming for the Miami-Dade Public Library System, trying to immunize young people against fake news.
I mean, I had a teacher in high school who taught me about reading between the lines kind of thing. I mean, that's what he used to call it. But I mean, he taught me how to discern things and how to look at several different news sources and make my own opinion. So it's been taught for years, and librarians were on the forefront of teaching that way before the internet was even developed. So it's not something we need special software for. It helps. But certainly librarians and teachers around the country can teach kids how to form their own opinions and be better citizens and engage civically and be involved in causes that they care about and research those causes.
Well, what convinced you and your colleagues that an anti-fake news effort was needed?
We felt that it was important for young people to be able to decipher facts from fiction and be able to use discernment when reading the news. Partially, I felt a personal connection to it because I fell victim to reposting inaccurate facts on social media a couple times. But I also, I've always had a concern about the amount of time that teenagers are spending on their phones or on their gadgets and not really talking to people about what they're digesting through the news or through social media.
Tell me about some of your own experience that you mentioned reposting fake news on Facebook or Twitter. What happened?
Well, I think some of the news sources on social media, at least a year ago, were not 100% accurate. So it was easy to fall victim if you didn't look at who was putting the news out. So there were some sources that mimicked real authoritative news channels or stations, but they weren't. The title was slightly different. And if you didn't look, you wouldn't realize that it was a made-up, you know, name. And there were memes put out that were meant to sway people's opinion. I think a lot of the posts that were being reposted by me and many other people that were inaccurate kind of played on people's prejudices or thoughts, preconceived ideas, caused people to react emotionally and repost without thinking and looking at who was putting the information out and without verifying the accuracy of the statement or the headline.
So how does your program combat that specifically?
Well, we're currently offering news literacy software at 6 locations. We're doing it in different ways. Some branches are doing it once a month. Some branches are doing it once a week. Some branches are doing it like a camp every day during the summer. And it shows videos of journalists talking about the difference between, you know, journalism that's been verified, what it takes to be a journalist, the importance of using accurate facts and things like that. So the way it helps the teens is that they're able to come together, look at some of the video and answer some questions, and then at the end they can talk to each other. The librarian is there to guide them or to answer any questions they may have. And, you know, I think the library has always played a role as a trusted institution, and librarians have always looked at ways of verifying information. You know, when we buy books, we look at the publisher. Is it a reputable publisher who published the book? We look at reviews. It's the same thing with social media and what's on the internet. We need to step back and look at who's putting out the information. You know, is there a slant? Is there a bias? Maybe look at a few different news sources on the same topic and see what they're saying.
So let's talk about a specific example, maybe. Let's say a kid walks into the library and says, you know, I just read that there's a pizza restaurant in Northwest DC where prominent Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, are running a child sex ring. Have you guys heard this?
If that instance happened, because we do build relationships with the teens in the libraries, and sometimes they do have questions like that, I would try to bring up an article that said that, and then I would try to help them decipher if that was an accurate or a reputable news source that was putting it out. So I would show them different ways to evaluate a website, different ways to evaluate a post in Facebook, to analyze what they're looking at before digesting it as truth.
Fake news and the jolt we get from it has been described as our addiction, let's say, to sugar. It just reinforces something that we want and we don't even know we want. And I wonder how hard of a job it is for you in the library and for others like you, you know, to convince people that they don't really love Skittles and don't want more Skittles.
I think it's important just to be unbiased because you don't know what the kids are facing at home. I have a friend who's a teacher who says that a lot of her kids are hearing from their parents, oh, you can't believe that newspaper, or you can't believe this newspaper. Or, you know, so there's a lot of adults even who are feeling like they don't trust the news or they don't trust government. And, you know, I think kids are hearing everything their parents are saying. They're hearing everything that's on the TV. And sometimes even at home, they're not allowed to express themselves if they don't agree with their parents. So in the library, they can have a neutral space where they can discuss any concerns or fears that they might be seeing on the TV or on social media. And it gives them an opportunity to kind of develop their thoughts and their own philosophies about things.
Jennifer Shipley with the Miami-Dade Public Library System. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Megan. I'm calling from Sammamish, Washington. Yes, I have fallen for fake news once. I fell for one about Trump's Twitter account being shut down. I fell for it because I wanted it to be true, and because of that, I didn't check the URL address. Later, after I had shared it on Facebook, I realized it was fake news. A friend had to point it out. It's incredibly embarrassing, and I was horrified that I had fallen for it.
Well, real Donald Trump is alive and well, for sure. Your stories of fake news in the real world, we're keeping it real as best we can. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can join our conversation on Twitter, at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.